in some colder air, but some sunshine and some wintry showers over the hills. But it is an improving sort of day, and as we head into Saturday night with much lighter winds, it'll be cold, there'll be a frost, but for many on Sunday, a lovely day, should be dry for most of us, with some sunshine.
Looking forward to that. Thanks, Darren. Darren Bett there at the BBC Weather Centre. The wind and the waves will be featuring large in the late night shipping bulletin. That's at 12 minutes to one. But now on Radio 4, Book of the Week, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle. In his revealing, sometimes irreverent take on all things Scandinavian, journalist and self-confessed misanthrope, Michael Booth even, is on the final stage of his personal odyssey through the Nordic regions in his quest to discover what has made this region such a success story. He's left Sweden to the last, the country which he believes has done more than any other to define how the rest of the world sees Scandinavia. The reader is Gunnar Kothry.
It is a Friday evening in Stortorget, Malmö. Around me, a crowd of thousands stands pressed tightly together beside long tables, their arms interlinked, swaying in time to a song sung in Swedish to the tune of My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean. The tables are cluttered with empty bottles and cans, the detritus of the largest crayfish orgy in the world, which is now reaching a crescendo of salty sucking and slurping. The traditional Swedish crayfish party, the Kräftskiva, is one of the Swedes' few self-sanctioned days of public disorder, a rare moment of unguarded merriment when they permit themselves to unleash their otherwise dormant Viking spirit. Several revellers have climbed onto the tables and are dancing, arms in the air, their shirts still tucked firmly into their shorts. This is Sweden. This is so not Sweden. We have finally arrived at the central piece of our Nordic puzzle, the hub, the crux, the Rosetta Stone by which so much of the cultural, political, social and interrelational history of Scandinavia can be deciphered. This is the country which has done more than any other to define how the rest of the world sees Scandinavia, as modern, liberal, collectivist and, Kräftskiva parties aside, a little dull. How we lap up news of their free schools and foundation hospitals, their harmonious middle-way consensus politics, and their economic and gender equality. A few years ago, the Swedish Institute of Public Opinion Research asked young Swedes to describe their compatriots. The top eight adjectives they chose, in descending order of relevance, were envious, stiff, industrious, nature-loving, quiet, honest, dishonest, and xenophobic. The bottom three out of 30 characteristics, i.e. those least exhibited by the Swedes, were masculine, sexy, and artistic. Swedish ethnologist Åke Daun writes, "Swedes seem to reflect a great deal on what they would like to say, how to say it and when, how other people might react, etc., before they actually say it, if they decide to do so at all." This fear of being ridiculed is reflected in one of the key words by which the Swedes define themselves, duktig. It literally translates as clever, but this is a specific type of Swedish cleverness. It is a diligent, responsible kind of clever, punctual, law-abiding, industrious clever. When they're not striving to be perceived by their fellow countrymen as duktig, the Swedes will seek to impress each other with how lagom they are. Lagom is another key Swedish watchword. It means moderate, reasonable, fair. Though it clearly resonates with Lutheran doctrines, its etymology is said to go much further back, to the Vikings. Legend has it that when they shared a horn of mead around the campfire, those gentle, caring, sharing Vikings would always remember to take care not to drink too much before passing the cup on to their neighbour. The boldest of Sweden's recent social experiments has been in the field of multiculturalism. Over the last 40 years, Scandinavia's largest country has welcomed more immigrants than any other European land. Today, almost 15% of the Swedish population was born outside of Sweden. And if you include the next generation, almost a third of the population was born outside of the country. Malmö's Rosengård estate, with its near 90% immigrant population, has come to symbolise all that is wrong with Sweden's open-door immigration policy. If you believe the rumours, it is a crime-ridden hellhole, a sink estate where the country herds its Somali, Iraqi and Afghani immigrants, denying them any hope of a decent life or income. Actually, Rosengård didn't look all that bad. From the outside, the tower blocks appeared to be well kept. Many had new facades. There were plenty of trees and greenery. I was intrigued to discover that Rosengård's most notorious group of apartment blocks, Herregården, where unemployment runs at 90%, borders Almgården, a predominantly white working-class housing complex, which has one of the largest proportions of voters for the anti-immigration Sweden Democrats. The party polled 36% of the votes cast in Almgården in the last election, compared with just under 6% nationally. So, the immigrants and asylum seekers on one side, the right-wing working class on the other. At the local mosque and Islamic centre, located within sight of two churches, I met Bajtsat Bechirov, who came to Sweden from his native Macedonia in the 1960s, and opened the mosque in 1984. Being a Western Muslim, he was proud that Sunnis and Shiites worshipped side by side here. In his view, Rosengård's chief problem was its poor housing. There are 20 people in some apartments, cockroaches. But also the more recent arrival of non-Western Muslims, often from conflict areas or far away areas of rural poverty. Not the same traditions. They are very slow to integrate. They might take 20 years. They have no language. Criminality grows. Sweden is a totalitarian state. Discuss. No, really, I'm serious. My dictionary defines totalitarianism as a form of government that includes control of everything under one authority and allows no opposition. And for much of the 20th century, Sweden was effectively a one-party state, the party being the Social Democrats. They regulated every aspect of their dutiful, acquiescent citizens' lives, doing their utmost to ensure adherence to the prescribed modern, progressive social norms. Modernity became the golden carrot dangled in front of Sweden's citizens by its ruling powers. If something was deemed modern, it was good. A rational, enlightened country such as Sweden had no need for folklore and buckled shoes, for rituals and community customs. Trade unions were modern. Collectivism was modern. Neutrality was modern. Economic and gender equality were modern. Divorce was modern. The welfare state was modern. Eventually, multiculturalism and mass immigration were deemed modern. Thanks to its ruthless pragmatism, collaborating and trading with the Nazis during the Second World War, Sweden sailed through the conflict, during which its gross national product rose by 20%. But its reputation was tarnished. The writer Sean French, who is half Swedish, feels that in burying their guilt about their betrayal of their Nordic neighbours during the war and about their extensive trade with the Nazis, the Swedes have paid the price in the longer term. After the war, the agreement that they would go for growth, retain a national consensus, and tacitly bury the past worked very well, but it's left a kind of scar. And in order to achieve that success, it gave up division, so there's agreement, or apparent agreement, on everything. I asked the historian Henrik Berggren about the Swedes' war guilt, or lack of it. Was their openness to immigration and multiculturalism a manifestation of this repressed guilt? Yes, it is war guilt, I think so, he said. Because prosperity in general in moral people does tend to create a sense of guilt. If you have a lot and someone else has a little, you get guilty anyway if you are of the Protestant persuasion. And the war, as you say, compounds the guilt. For Berggren, the real aim of the post-war Swedish government was to liberate its citizens from each other, to set them free and allow them to become fully autonomous, independent entities in charge of their own destinies. The Swedish system is best understood not in terms of socialism, but in terms of Rousseau, says Berggren. Rousseau was an extreme egalitarian and he hated any kind of dependence. Depending on other people destroyed your integrity, your authenticity. In Sweden, the main objective is not to be dependent on your family. The wife shouldn't be dependent on her husband. The children should be autonomous when they are 18. Old people should not be dependent on their children taking care of them. And therefore, to a large extent, the state steps in and provides these things. But the state is not saying this is how you should live your life, but it is providing you with the support structure. It seems to me that the problem with this form of social engineering is that it takes many of the Swedes' underlying characteristics, particularly their love of being alone and isolated, and really lets them run with it. Thus, today in Sweden, most students live by themselves. The Swedes have the highest divorce rate in the world, and more of their elderly live alone than in any other country. Swedish autonomy also seemed to me to be much more passive than the kind of independence the Americans strive for. It is not about achieving something, grabbing life by the lapels and wringing every ounce of potential from it. It is about being able to get your teeth seen to on a regular basis, for spouses to be able to take separate holidays, or for pensioners to be free to decide what to have for dinner. But in eradicating social ills, has the Social Democratic Party also smothered its people's motivation, ambition, and spirit? Henrik Berggren again. There is a conformity. It is usually much easier to be eccentric in a diverse society. I don't think Sweden will generate the kind of thinking that comes out of specific groups who develop a strong sensibility of the self. Though they may look alike at first glance, the Nordic peoples are wildly, fascinatingly different from each other. They have different genetic roots, different mentalities, different histories, and different economic systems. Some have oil and gas, others have trees or hot air. One has the euro, another is outside the EU altogether. And there is an element of the Nordic happiness phenomenon that I have not yet mentioned, at least not explicitly. It is no coincidence that the region that is consistently judged to have the highest levels of well-being and life quality also has the greatest equality of educational opportunity, and according to a London School of Economics study comparing the incomes of fathers and sons over 30 years, among the very highest levels of social mobility in the world. The four main Nordic countries occupied the top four places on the list. Crucial to this social mobility are the schools. In Scandinavia, the standard of education is not only the best in the world, but the opportunities it presents are available to all, free of charge. It is the bedrock of Nordic exceptionalism. Every once in a while, a Nordic politician or member of the Nordic Council issues a clarion call for the Nordic countries to come together to form a Nordic Union, to unite economically and militarily, with a joint army, joint foreign policy, and even a joint currency. Something along the lines of the EU, but without the squabbling and corruption. There has been increasing discussion about this in the Scandinavian media in recent years, with some suggesting a federal states of Scandinavia. It is still unlikely. Just in case, though, my plea to the Nordic people is this. Please don't. For if you ever really did band together in such a way, then, truly, the rest of us would not stand a chance.
Gunnar Kothrie was reading The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle by Michael Booth. The book was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And before the shipping bulletin, it's sailing by. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 15th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Ireland, 958, expected Viking, 967 by 1800 Saturday. Low, just north of Fair Isle, 979, losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cira, south at Cira, northeast 40s. Southeasterly, gale 8 to storm 10, becoming cyclonic 6 to gale 8 later. Rain or showers, moderate or poor. Southwest 40s, Cromarty 4th. Cyclonic, becoming northwesterly 6 to gale 8. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Tyne, Dogger, Fisher. Southerly or south.